Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. How do our eating habits affect the health of the world's oceans? Global per capita fish consumption has doubled in the past half century, which might be good for human health, but poses an existential threat to the planet's largest ecosystem. As my guest today has discovered, reliable strategies already allow for fish to be harvested in sustainable ways, whether farm-raised or wild-caught. The problem is that some seafood producers are making choices that could lead to profits now and scarcity in the long term. Paul Greenberg is a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellow and a W.K. Kellogg Foundation Food and Society Policy Fellow. His new book is called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Paul, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks, Chris.
Why is it that it's so easy for us to think of deer and bears and other land animals as wildlife, but we think of ocean animals first and foremost as food sources?
Well, yeah, I mean, the biggest barrier, obviously, is out of sight, out of mind. The ocean is this plane under which people who don't scuba dive or snorkel or go fishing, they never go below. And so, you know, you have practices that are carried out against wild fish, the likes of which, if they were carried out on land, would be considered, you know, frankly, inhuman. You wouldn't drag a net along the Serengeti Plain, knocking down trees and scooping up zebras and lions and so forth, and then picking out a few wildebeest. But in fact, that's, you know, that's like what bottom trawling is, and that's the main way that we get a lot of our seafood today, by dragging the bottom clean of wildlife.
Now, beyond human hunger, talk about the consequences of overfishing to the overall ecosystem.
Well, there's a lot of complicated things that we're only now starting to get a handle on. Some of your listeners have probably heard about the phenomenon of ocean acidification, and that is linked to climate change, whereby, you know, the actual pH of the ocean appears to be growing more acidic. Something I uncovered in my research was that fish, actually fish excrement, for lack of a better word, is chemically basic. And so the more fish we take out of the sea, the less of a buffer we have against ocean acidification. So that, you know, that's one just very huge, you know, sweeping thing. On another level, though, you know, if you continue to harvest fish in very, very large numbers, if you go beyond a certain kind of percentage of a population removed from the sea, you really start to affect that individual population's genetics. So, like in the case of Canadian cod, a lot of people have heard about, you know, the cod collapses of the 80s and 90s. The largest stocks of cod that were in Canada, it seems that we've artificially selected for small cod because we were catching all these big cod year in and year out, and the genetics for those big cod just might not exist anymore, and that's one of the reasons those Canadian cod stocks just aren't really rebuilding like we'd like to see.
Paul, why is it that we're eating more fish than we did before? Is it about the ability to reliably transport seafood to just about any place in the world?
That's one of it. You know, deep freezing technology, and there's a special kind of container, you know, a cold container that was invented in the 70s that really helped that. But, you know, the bigger trend really goes back to World War II. Just after World War II, you know, agriculture throughout Europe and Asia was devastated. And people needed to figure out something to eat, and they needed to figure it out fast. And that, coupled with the fact that all of these different industrial technologies had been developed during the war, sonar, polymers, huge supplies of oil were discovered. So all those tools allowed people to suddenly really ramp up what's called the fishing effort. And so for the next 50 years, you know, people kept fishing because they could, and they could always find more fish. And technology, as you say, with, you know, the ability to transport those fish around the world, kind of, you know, glommed on to that trend and just made it go up and up. Of course, there's also, in recent years, you know, the famed omega-3 fatty acid, which the triglycerides actually help cardiovascular health. There's a lot of evidence that they help neural development in young children. And oily fish are very high in those omega-3s, and I think that message has gotten out to the public, and it's making people in developed countries who have this information more apt to choose fish, in spite of the fact that, you know, it might not always be the most environmentally correct choice.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because I think a lot of people assume that eating fish is automatically greener than eating something grown on land, a meat, at least.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I say, you know, in the book, fish is the last wild food. It is greener than organic in the sense that, you know, you don't have to do anything to get fish, to get wild fish. You just have to catch it. The world makes it for us. But the problem comes when, you know, this, and it's just a larger problem of global ecology, when humans really outnumber the rest of the creatures on Earth, or at least outnumber in terms of the energy, the food energy they require. So, you know, once upon a time, before World War II, when fishing effort was more artisanal, when there weren't that many of us in the world, you know, we could harvest a fair amount of fish. It's when we subject wild animals to an industrial practice, to industrial harvest, that's when we start to see these wild animals not really having the wherewithal to withstand that kind of pressure.
Now, I know that you yourself have been fishing for decades.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what made you start thinking about the sustainability of the way this is done, particularly commercially?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, like I think a lot of people in Texas are fishermen, mm-hmm. and I think they'll relate to this feeling that, you know, that fishing is this way to really bond with the wild. You know, for those of us who aren't really kind of like bird watchers or, you know, sort of more passive kinds of things, angling really kind of, you know, you put 2 feet into the water, so to speak, and you're really, really engaging with these things. But what's interesting, you know, funny thing that really started getting me thinking about it is I noticed a lot of anglers turning to the practice of catch and release. In other words, you know, you don't kill your prey, you let it go, and so forth. But then I noticed that those same fish that I was catching and releasing, I was also seeing in the fish market. And I was thinking, well, why do I have to catch and release fish when they're being harvested in these huge numbers by commercial interests? So, you know, I guess I follow the line, so to speak, from my own fishing effort to the global fishing effort and tried to see what, you know, what was really going on with fish. Because I don't think, you know, sports anglers are actually, in the end, they're often great ecologists, and they often contribute to the environmental health of our waters by defending them. So, you know, I think it's an interesting, it brought up a lot of interesting issues as it was going along.
It is interesting, too, that I know a lot of people who love to fish who wouldn't think about taking a rifle out into the woods or onto the prairie somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing is you can throw back a fish if you catch it, right? You can throw back a deer if you shoot it. So there, I think there's that element. But again, it goes back to this question of fish being, you know, frankly, when I grew up and, you know, as you grow up fishing, you can gradually take on more and different fish. And fish to a young fisherman are they're kind of like sports cars. Mm-hmm. You know, each of them has a kind of different shape, and it's like they're kind of collectibles. And you don't quite think of them as animals in the way that, you know, a deer, when you shoot a deer and you touch the hide of it, you can feel its warmth coming off. So I think the fact that fish are cold-blooded, the fact that we don't see them, you know, in our daily lives all the time, that they come out of this darkness and on our line, that, you know, it's a little bit of a break that you know, fishermen can stomach when they can't stomach hunting.
So on the commercial side, you show us here that a lot of deep ocean commercial fishermen in particular go at this almost like Neolithic hunter-gatherers, in the sense that they hunt down their prey without regard necessarily for whether or not it will still be in the same place in another year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the story of fishing up until about 1995. You know, fishing has expanded, commercial fishing has expanded progressively from primarily a northern hemisphere activity to now something that pretty much encompasses every piece of water on the globe. And you can see this, you know, if you track, like, codfish, for example, you know, codfish collapse on the Grand Banks in Canada in the late 80s, then Alaska pollock becomes this big fish that we go after soon thereafter. And now it's another fish called the New Zealand hoki, which comes from the southern hemisphere altogether. So, yeah, it's this sort of open-ended pattern. We can always find another fish. We can always find something else. We can always go to new grounds. And I think that the story of the next 10 years of ocean conservation and sustainable fishing is going to be about closing that circle and about ending that endless pursuit of fresh grounds and fresh fish.
Well, it would seem like fishing companies would have a vested interest in ensuring that they are working sustainably, because
yeah,
their long-term survival relies on fish populations.
Yeah, I mean, and there, don't get me wrong, there are companies that do that. It's just that, you know, it's a hard business. Profit margins can be pretty, pretty thin. And sometimes, you know, most fish stocks out there have some kind of quota system, some kind of means of, you know, saying this is how much you should take and so forth. But the urge to just kind of goose it a little bit, to kind of go over a little bit what the catch limit is, is always there, and it's not, there's just not enough control by and large to make sure that we follow these scientific guidelines. So, you know, maybe we started out as Neolithic hunters. I don't think we're there now. I think we're now, we know what we're doing. We know what we could do to have less damaging effects on the seas. The question is, do we have the will as a species to do it?
What about restrictions on fishing in international waters?
Yeah, well, that's the biggest problem of all, right? You know, used to be a nation's territorial waters ended at the distance you could shoot a cannonball. So in other words, where the cannonball fell, that's where your territory ended. But through the years, countries have gotten more and more ownership of the seas in front of them. So, you know, in 1982, the UN Law of the Sea established it so that every country owns their sea up to 200 nautical miles. And this has actually been good for fish because, you know, you can say, this is my territory. I have scientists who can tell me how much I can catch, and, you know, and this is how we're going to fish them. Beyond 200 miles, though, is a kind of no man's land, as you point out. You know, international waters are regulated by these sort of mini United Nations bodies that set these quotas and so forth, but they're very, very hard to restrict. And, you know, the real victim of that is tuna, and all species of tuna cross international waters and are really getting hit hard right now.
Yeah, one of the issues is that tuna is a really large fish, and so I guess it's quite profitable to pull a tuna out of the ocean.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's, you know, there are, you know, several dozen species of tuna to begin with, but the ones that we hear about most, you know, the Atlantic bluefin tuna, which, you know, spawns in the Gulf of Mexico, that's a very big fish, as you point out. It's, you know, it can be up to 15 feet long, over 1,000 pounds, but it's not just its size that makes it profitable. There's a kind of fetishization that's gone on, I think. You know, 30 years ago, when people would catch a bluefin, quite frankly, they would usually just take a picture of it, and then they'd take it to the town dump and throw it out.
Hmm.
Even in Japan, it really wasn't a very appreciated fish. In fact, sushi chefs used to call it chibi, which means 4 days, because you were supposed to bury a tuna, a bluefin, in the ground for 4 days to help it kind of lose its bloody taste before you ate it. So, but what's happened is this sort of fetishization, and I can only liken it to like the way certain countries fetishize tiger parts, you know. And it's not that bluefin is a traditional medicine or something, but it's got this tinge of wild animal to it, and I think it keeps driving up the price, you know, so that, you know, fish are selling for $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 a piece. I don't think it necessarily reflects, you know, how good a thing it is to eat for the palate. It's a fetish at this point.
It's remarkable that we can be so influenced by something like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, but think about it. You know, wildness is something that's disappearing from our lives. And when things get scarce, people in the wild, when wild things get scarce, people treasure them. Think of truffles, for example. You know, they have to be dug up by pigs. Nobody plants truffles. They just kind of, they're out there. And you know, I think it's one of the big challenges to human intelligence right now is, can you, instead of just turning the oceans into a feedlot, which, you know, a lot of fish farming could threaten to do, can we actually look at this very complex ecosystem and take just enough that we get our food out of it, but also leave just enough so that the ecosystem remains in balance?
Paul Greenberg is my guest. He's a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellow and a W.K. Kellogg Foundation Food and Society Policy Fellow. His new book is called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Paul Greenberg is my guest. Our conversation this hour focuses on the contents of his new book, Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. So, Paul, we've enumerated some of the obvious issues with pulling fish out of the oceans wild. There's also the question of farming, which can be great or it can be really of some concern.
Yeah. I mean, the trend in what we call aquaculture or fish farming has really been set by the domestication of Atlantic salmon, you know, which happened in the late 1960s. And the problem with a lot of fish farming as it happens is people tend to farm fish where the wild fish are happiest. So what you saw throughout the 1950s and 60s was a huge decline in wild Atlantic salmon. In fact, you know, you might see in the marketplace Irish salmon or Scottish salmon or Nova Scotia salmon. All of those fish are wild. Are farmed at this point. Wild Atlantic salmon simply just does not exist in the marketplace anymore. It's commercially extinct. And so what's happened is all of those runs have been really, really severely reduced. And to complicate matters, people have started farming salmon right in the bays and estuaries where wild salmon migrate. And so you have all these problems of potentially of disease transmission from, you know, anytime you get a large, you know, as you know probably from Texas, anytime you get a large bunch of farm animals together, diseases are going to crop up. And this happens with salmon. The difference is, though, with cattle, there's no wild cattle around there that these diseases can spread to. But with salmon, they can spread. And we get, you know, we've had problems with something called infectious salmon anemia that wiped out about half the salmon crop last year, or sorry, in 2008. And then we also get a really horrible feature called a sea louse, which is like almost like a tick that attacks salmon and appears on salmon farms and appears to be very damaging to wild salmon stock. So it is a real problem. We're sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul a lot of times with these salmon farming operations.
Well, and based on their life cycles and their habits and the way they move, it would seem like salmon would be a very difficult fish to farm anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I say in the book that if we were to do this all over again, we probably would not have chosen salmon. Salmon are highly carnivorous. It may take as many as 3 to 6 pounds of wild forage fish harvested from the wild to grow a single pound of salmon. But actually what's interesting the reason that salmon probably were domesticated in the first place goes back to their egg. Have you ever eaten salmon caviar, you know, those big red eggs that you sometimes see in a fish market?
Sure.
Yeah, so that's very telling. Those big red eggs, or orange, I guess, when the fish hatch, they've got a big yolk sac hanging from their belly, and they can live off that yolk sac for a number of days, and then they can transition directly to like little feed pellets and grow to normal size entirely under human husbandry. A lot of the other fish that we've been trying to recently raise in captivity, they hatch out of tiny, tiny eggs, and they require all this very complex microscopic live feed to get them to an adult phase, and cracking that code took like 20 years from about late 1960s to the mid 1980s for those other fish other than salmon to become commercially farmed species.
Now there are some fish that seem to be really good candidates for farm raising, and tilapia is one of them.
Tilapia is an excellent one, mostly because it doesn't require any fish meal at all to be grown. You can feed it corn and soy. And actually, you know, it's interesting. Tilapia made it onto our market mostly through the avenue of the Peace Corps. I don't know if there's any Peace Corps volunteers out there listening, but during the 60s and 70s, Peace Corps volunteers spread out around the world, and they found that tilapia put in a little rice pond or rice paddy, could live off algae and all sorts of just other wastes that were in the water, and they would be this sort of easy protein source. What happens, a lot of Peace Corps volunteers returned home, and they thought, well, could we make this fish into a first-world fish? Could we clean up its taste a little bit and really get it going? And it turns out, yes, and you can grow a tilapia in 6 or 7, 8 months. You can grow them in recirculating systems that don't interact with the wild. They're very feed efficient. It's a good fish, and, it's low in fat, and, I would recommend it.
And it is, when we're choosing, it's sometimes better to look for a smaller fish than a larger one.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, that's, more of an issue of wild, with wild fish. But, the younger, the smaller the fish, the shorter its lifespan, means, A, it won't accumulate toxins as quickly. So like a mackerel, which is actually in the same family as, say, a bluefin tuna, A mackerel lives only a couple of years. It grows quickly, and it doesn't accumulate the toxins like the bluefin. The other thing is that these smaller fish tend to reproduce very quickly, so they stand up to fishing pressure more. So, you know, the smaller the fish, probably most cases of the time, is a better ecological and often a better health choice.
Are farmed fish more likely to be exposed to, if not toxins, things like anti-disease agents and antibiotics and things like that?
You know, it's funny. It depends. It's really like Alice through Looking Glass kind of material. It depends on who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fishermen and wild fish advocates will say, you know, farms are, you know, fish farms often have antibiotics in the feed. You know, there's been a whole issue of PCB contamination in some feeds that come from polluted areas, like in the northern hemisphere. Anchovies and menhaden and things like that often will have toxins in them that they pass on to the fish. On the other hand, what the fish farmers counter to the wild fish people is, well, you know, at least we know where our fish have been. They've been in our net. We know what we fed them. We can test them. You folks out there, you know, you fishermen, you're harvesting from this increasingly polluted world. We don't know where these fish have been, and they're going to vary from fish to fish. In fact, I came across one company that's doing boat-side mercury testing, where they're literally testing fish as they come out of the water to see, you know, which ones have high and which ones have low mercury. And, you know, on the one hand, that's good because, you know, some people will be able to afford these sort of lower mercury fish. But then what happens to the fish with the higher mercury? Do those just get, you know, lower price and sold to poorer people? It's a little depressing.
Have the mercury levels in the ocean risen in recent decades, or is it just something that we are newly aware of?
You know, the mercury thing is complicated. The thing that really got people thinking about mercury was an incident that happened in Japan in the Bay of Minamata. There was the Chiso Corporation was making acetohydrate, I think. I might be mangling that word, but it was a chemical very rich in methyl mercury. And so you had these incredibly horrible birth defects that happened from this very contained bay of people eating the local seafood. And I think that really planted the image of mercury poisoning in the mind for a lot of people. But subsequently, we do have rising issues of mercury in the environment. And mostly where mercury comes from is coal-fired plants. Coal seams often will have mercury in them. And mercury in and of itself is not as toxic as, say, what happens when you burn coal. When you burn coal, you do something to mercury called methylating it, and you make it into basically a sticky compound that then, you know, can cause different problems and attaches to human flesh and, you know, can cause, you know, neural effects, you know, all sorts of different things. What I always say, you know, people in the fishing industry often say, you know, well, you know, it's the consumer can just choose the right fish. We know which has high mercury and we know which doesn't. But I kind of turn around and say, you know, why do we have any mercury in our seafood at all? If the U.S. government had the will to make coal-fired plants have mercury scrubbers installed, then this mercury issue could conceivably go away, at least in our local waters.
Paul Greenberg is with us. His new book is Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. And we'll go on the phones now to Tao in Hillsboro. Hi, Tao.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions. The first one, I'm from Vietnam, South Vietnam. I grew up there in the 60s, 70s, immigrated to the United States in 83.
Great. I was there just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and I remember when I was young, fish are very abundant and low price.
Yeah.
And when I, you know, immigrated to the United States and talked to friends in Europe and Japan, seafood is so expensive.
Yeah.
It never makes sense to me, and you can get them, you know, easily in South Vietnam. So what's the explanation for that? The other thing is I'm a physician, and as you know, I recommend recommend people to eat fish, and they don't eat these fish that we recommended. And I'm sorry for missing part of the show, but if my patients consume fish as much as recommended, well, we have a problem.
Yeah, well, to your first question, why are fish more expensive? You know, it's really a question of supply. In this country, it's funny, if you go back into the sort of records of the National Marine Fisheries Service, there were huge campaigns in the 40s, 50s, and 60s to try and get Americans to eat more fish. And they did, and we caught more fish to the point where, you know, now we really have caught too many of them. So I really think it's a question of supply and demand. I also think that fish has been held up as this healthy food. And that has also done something as well. Now, Vietnam is a different story in that actually Vietnam has a great aquaculture industry. They grow a fish called the Pangasius catfish, which is actually an extremely productive fish. And that's something that's really kind of boomed on the market. In fact, exports from Vietnam to Europe of Pangasius catfish have gotten to the point where they rival cod and pollock and other white flesh fish. Now, the other question you had, I'm not sure I quite understood, but why is it that, should we be recommending people to eat more fish? Was that the question?
I think what he was talking about was if people ate as much fish as he, as a physician, recommends, we're not going to have enough.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's true. Yeah, I mean, the British Health Department, for example, says that we should eat one portion of white fish and one portion of oily fish a week. And I ran the numbers on this, and what it came out to be was that we would need to pull out of the ocean the equivalent of the human weight of the world every year. Hmm. Currently, we pull about the human weight of China out of the year every year, just by comparison's sake. No, we wouldn't have enough fish, and it is a problem, and it's one of the reasons that aquaculture is the fastest-growing form of food production in the world. 50 years ago, everything we ate from the sea was wild. Now about half of it is. And aquaculture continues to grow. Whether it can meet that demand that the world needs, it's hard to say. And unfortunately, there's going to be, I think, a first world, third world divide in the people who can eat this healthy diet of fish and those who just won't be able to afford it. It might be inevitable, unfortunately.
Is there a significant difference in taste, Paul, between fish that are responsibly grown in an aquaculture setting as opposed to those that are caught wild?
I'm not too much of a purist. One of the major reasons that you see a difference in taste, say, between farmed salmon and wild salmon is that we're talking about different species.
Mm-hmm.
Most farmed salmon are Atlantic salmon, and they're not only a different species, they're actually a different genus altogether. So there's that difference right there. That said, I do think that the wild fish have a little bit more distinction to them. Fish farmers tend to grow fish to be a little bit neutral tasting because they know that's sort of what the market wants. And if you talk about a fish like a tilapia, for example, which is always farmed, tilapia don't really taste like anything. And on one hand, you could say, well, that's a problem. On the other hand, cod don't really taste like anything to my palate. So I think if you're looking for just a kind of a neutral, industrial fish that you can use in fish sticks or a filet-o-fish sandwich, flavor is not really that big an issue. You're just sort of looking for protein. If you're looking for sort of a delicate, careful texture with a subtle taste that maybe you'd have more infrequently, then, probably wild fish is what you're going to prefer to eat.
We have an email here from Paul in Farmers Branch who writes, "Catch and release by some sports fishermen seems like a form of animal cruelty or torture. Mm-hmm. If this were done to land animals, it would be illegal." What do you think about that?
Well, I tend to agree. I'm not really a catch and release fisherman, and I can, my fellow sports fishermen out there are maybe going to burn me in effigy, but I think if you're going to go fishing, let's face it, you're trying to capture something. And there are certain species and river systems and so forth that can't stand up to everybody taking a fish. If everybody in the Colorado Rockies was a catch-and-keep angler, there just wouldn't be any trout left. So, it's not a question of animal cruelty there. It's just a question of actual species or that stock's survival. There have been some improvements made in catch-and-release angling. One thing that could seriously improve fish stocks all over our coast, there's something called a circle hook, which is, I won't go into its description, but what it does, it has the effect that when a fish bites a circle hook, instead of it swallowing the hook, it somehow rotates to the corner of the fish's mouth and just hooks it in the corner, and it makes catch and release angling that much easier. If all anglers switched to circle hooks, the amount of surviving fish in the water would be dramatically increased, and I'd love to see that practice adopted.
What about, is there much thought given by fish farmers to quality of life for the fish that exist in these places?
It's a great question. Yeah, I mean, it depends on your producer. In England, they tend to be much more interested in animal rights. Mm-hmm. And they have something there called the five freedoms that every farmed animal is entitled to, freedom from suffering, freedom from overcrowding, and things like that. And the fish farmers I've talked to in England do follow those things. Not always, but, you know, those sort of more artisanal people do think about the quality of life. I do know that a swift and careful death actually improves the flesh quality. So unlike wild fish, which often, you know, are pulled out of the sea and sometimes can lay on the deck of a boat for a while, a lot of fish farming operations will extract a fish, you know, from its net pen, and it'll go right into an ice slurry. So it'll be literally flash frozen, or flash, not frozen, but flash cooled to death. And some would say that's a more humane way to kill something than you know, just letting it flop around on a deck.
So it happens that quickly, I guess?
It does happen very quickly. And that has the effect of, you know, I think easing the fish's transition to rigor mortis. And I've heard it causes less gaping in the flesh, which makes it more presentable product when you bring it to market.
We have Max on the line in Duncanville. Hello, Max.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I want to ask about fish oil supplements, or those sustainable or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what about krill? Is that a endangered supplement?
Well, fish oil supplements, first of all, have many, many different sources. There's been some problems. You know, there's a company called Omega Protein, which has been harvesting a lot of a fish called a menhaden. And some would say they've been over-harvesting that fish. There have also been some issues. Again, a lot of fish oil supplements come from forage fish, which are these small fish. And generally, those that come from northern hemisphere sources tend to have possibilities of higher pollutants. The southern hemisphere is just overall cleaner than the northern hemisphere. So, you know, you're going to want to look for, if you're really concerned about environmental toxins, you know.
Let me have you pause right there because we need to take a quick break. Paul Greenberg is with us. His new book is called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Paul Greenberg is my guest this hour. He's a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellow. His new book is called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Before the break, Paul, you were talking about what to look for in fish oil supplements, and you were saying Northern Hemisphere is better than Southern Hemisphere?
No, it's the Southern Hemisphere that's generally less polluted than the Northern. And supplements that are made from Peruvian anchoveta, if you can track that down. I've got to do a little more research on this because people keep asking me about where can I find the good supplements. It's called Four Fish, not Four Supplements in the book, so I will do a little more research and get some info back to your website. But the other question the caller had, which I think is interesting, he asked about krill. And for those listeners who don't know it, krill are a small crustacean. A lot of it is harvested around Antarctica. And increasingly it's being used for a range of industrial purposes, but one of the problems is that it's being harvested at this rate, while it might be sustainable for the krill itself to keep reproducing and reproducing, it's not being harvested in such a way that takes into account the rest of the ecosystem. So they're taking out a lot of krill out of the area around Antarctica, but it seems to be having an effect on marine mammals and on fish populations. So, you know, it's something that we have to be really careful going forward, that we don't sort of pull the rug out from underneath these marine ecosystems.
One thing that can be really challenging is, you know, you make the decision if you're going to eat fish that you want to eat what is healthful and sustainably grown.
Yep.
It can be hard to know. My cousin, who actually works for a watershed preservation authority in Idaho, turned me on to the little Monterey Bay card.
Yeah, yeah.
And I learned from you that it's actually an iPhone app now.
Yes, it is indeed. Yeah, it's a great thing. You can download it to your iPhone and it adjusts for whatever region you're in. And I think, you know, people have disagreements with their ratings, and there are different organizations that do different ratings, but to my mind, Monterey Bay is the best and most thorough. And if you want to dig a little deeper, and you know, you don't, you know, what it does is it sort of rates fish according to best choice, good alternative, and avoid. And if you want to go a little deeper, what's interesting that Monterey Bay has is it has a little PDF profile of each fish, And you can read about it. You can read about its life history. You can read about the techniques that are used to catch it or to grow it in captivity. And I kind of would like everyone to kind of, you know, I think you got to know the biographies of the animals that you eat if you're going to eat them. You know, it will help us, I think, moving forward if everybody knows what it is that we're doing.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point that comes through in the book, that we should sort of know what these animals are. I mean, some of them, there are fish that people eat that I think they couldn't pick out of a lineup if they saw them whole and swimming around.
That's right. Well, you know, it's funny. I was talking to a fish wholesaler in Chatham, Mass., and, if, you know, people have been back east. It's, you know, it's Cape Cod. It's where cod comes from. And he was telling me recently, he said people come down to the dock and asked him for some nice, fresh, wild tilapia. Now, as we were discussing earlier, tilapia is a farmed fish, you know, that hails from Africa. There's no way there's a wild tilapia is going to show up on the dock at Cape Cod. But I think people have gotten very, very distant from the ocean. And what's fun, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier about how fish to me are like race cars, like each one has a neat, cool design, I think people would benefit and the world would benefit if people got to know these designs and to know these animals, have a more intimate relationship and a more respectful relationship with them.
Talk for a minute about bass. We often see it in restaurants and in stores. It's called sea bass, but in fact, a lot of it's farmed.
Yeah, well, bass is one of those catch-all words. Anglers out there listening know that, you know, you have in Texas your big mouth bass. You know, there's the famous Chilean sea bass that came onto the market in the early 80s. But really, there are, to my count, about 8 different taxonomic families that have fish in them that we call bass at one time or another. But the thing, the fish that's in my book that really is, I think, the sort of most important species for the moment is this European sea bass. And sometimes you'll see it on the menu as Branzino or Loup de Mer or Robalo or just plain bass or sea bass. But that's actually a farmed fish. It almost always comes to our shores farmed. There are small wild populations of them left in the Mediterranean. But it's been farmed since probably the mid-70s, and it's actually the taming of European sea bass was probably one of the most important things that happened in aquaculture, because once we tamed that, it opened up the possibility to tame pretty much everything in the sea.
One thing that you learned is that the best aquaculture is often not monoculture. Can you talk about why it's so important to mix species?
Sure. Well, you know, we're learning this on land, right? I mean, more and more we're seeing that just growing corn or just growing beef in a CAFO isn't good for the environment. It produces too much waste, and it, you know, it's just out of balance. What I came across is a really interesting guy named Terry Chopin, who's doing polyculture of salmon, mussels, edible seaweed, and sea cucumbers in the Bay of Fundy in Canada. And what's interesting is that, you know, the salmon are the ones that really produce waste, but all the other creatures filter waste and make use of it and turn it into useful things for humans. So instead of just, like, dumping a bunch of feed pellets in and having a lot of salmon poop on the bottom, you have, you know, great-tasting mussels, you know, really useful seaweeds and sea cucumbers that, you know, we don't eat them quite yet here in this country, but, you know, have a very high export value in Asia. So if we can get to those kind of balanced systems, instead of, like, genetically modifying salmon, which is, you know, increasingly something people are talking about, what we really should be doing is fixing the farm itself, making the farm more productive and more diverse and more resistant to pollution and disease.
What about waste? There are a lot of parts of vertebrate fish that we just don't eat in this country.
Yes. Well, I'm a big fan of if I were to start a movement, it would be the whole fish movement in that, you know, I used to only get one meal out of a fish, but now I can get 3 or 4. You can do interesting things with heads and, you know, chowders and fish cakes out of everything. But, you know, an interesting use for fish waste, I think, is actually aquaculture. In Europe, for example, where they have a long tradition of an organic certification for aquacultured fish, one of the things is that you have to get organic certification, you can't use or you have to highly reduce direct catch of wild fish to feed your fish. And so what they've been finding that there's a lot of ways of reprocessing, you know, skin, bones, all this stuff into fish meal that you can then use to grow aquacultured fish. Some people might be put off by that, but to me, you know, that's closing the cycle and eliminating waste and a good thing ecologically to do in a more crowded world.
Talk for a minute about how aquaculture can work into the Eat Local movement.
Well, in, you know, aquaculture, you know, traditionally has been in these sort of in-sea facilities that can be, you know, as I said before, very dangerous to wild fish. But there are these what are called recirculating aquaculture facilities where the fish are completely out of the ocean altogether. And there's actually a guy named Jonathan Zohar at the University of Maryland in Baltimore that has a recirculating facility set up in downtown Baltimore, and he's growing all kinds of fish there. And I think those kind of models, even though they're a little bit energy intensive, you know, they do decrease the food miles and put the fish right where the diners are. And I'd like to see more of those facilities, you know, crop up in cities around the country.
I know it's still relatively early, although we feel like we've been dealing with this forever. But can you talk about the kind of impact we can expect on fish supplies? And you mentioned bluefin tuna earlier, of the spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Gulf of Mexico? You know, if I were a Gulf fisherman, one of the things I'd be the most irritated and angry about is the loss of reputation. Because, you know, Gulf seafood, I love Gulf seafood. I imagine a lot of people in Texas must love it, too. And in point of fact, you know, there is a large portion of the seafood that's been affected by the spill, but there's also a large portion that hasn't been. And a lot of fishermen, shrimpers outside of the spill area, are finding their prices go down, and even processing facilities shuttered because the reputation has suffered so much. So personally, you know, I'm gonna eat Gulf shrimp this summer. Beyond shrimp, though, there are some bigger problems. The bluefin tuna, one of the largest fish that we eat, spawns in the Gulf of Mexico, and it was spawning right when the spill happened. And so, you know, that's a fish that's really going to be hurt long term by this spill, and that's a fish that I think people need to kind of lay off catching for a while to see if it can rebuild in the face of all this.
What does it take in areas where whatever the local fish population has been really decimated by overfishing, to bring those stocks back? How long do we have to wait, and at what point can we go back in and say, okay, it's safe to pull fish out of the ocean?
It's funny. The government actually passed something called an add-on to a big fisheries legislation called the Sustainable Fisheries Act, and it actually requires that all fish species, commercial fish species in the United States, be rebuilt by, I think it was either 2012 or 2015. Some of those deadlines have been extended, but it's actually been a useful tool, and what it does is it empowers local regulators to take the very extreme case of just shutting down fishing grounds, you know, until those targets are met. It has worked in some cases. The Gulf of Maine codfish population is rebuilding in a pretty good way. Haddock on the East Coast is rebuilding in a pretty good way. So oftentimes just not catching the fish is important. We also must take into account environmental degradation. Striped bass, which again is a fish I know in its freshwater form, is caught in Texas. That was a fish that in the wild, in the saltwater part of its range, was down to only about 5 million animals in 1982. Now it's up to around 55 million, and that's largely due to a reduction of fishing pressure, but also restoration and cleaning up of a lot of the estuaries where it spawns. It's still got serious environmental challenges, but there's a fish that made a real comeback.
Can you talk, and I don't remember too much of this in the book, but talk about invasive species and what you've learned.
Well, you know, somebody wrote an op-ed a while back for the Times saying, you know, if you want to control an invasive species, we should eat it. And you've heard, no doubt, about the Asian carp that seems to have just broken into the Great Lakes. We've got snakeheads in the Mississippi River that I think are from Asia originally. Actually, and you know, the invasive species thing happens sometimes because there is a tradition in several countries in Asia that when you eat a fish, it's considered sort of respectful to release a live one back into the water, which is all well and good if you're in a country where that fish is native. But when you have live fish like tilapia that are often sold live and you let them go in a warm climate, they will, you know, take over the water. So it is a problem. I personally would like to see a fishing show called Invasion, where, you know, you just promote this idea of catching and eating these invasive species and getting them out of our native waters as quickly as possible.
We've talked about a little bit about the four fish that you focus on here.
Yep.
Are there things that we can be eating instead that are comparable in taste and function and texture, but maybe you're a little bit better for the planet?
Yeah, I mean, each of the fish in the book has its sort of better doppelganger. So if you start with salmon, you know, the Alaska wild salmon, a lot of it is pretty good and a lot of it is pretty well managed, but, you know, there's not enough of it so that we can have it all the time. So I kind of think of Alaska salmon as something you could have, you know, once or twice a month, and you know, we should pay top dollar for it. But the aquacultured equivalent that actually does work pretty well is a fish called an Arctic char. It's a relatively new fish to the market, and it is in the salmon family. It's grown in recirculating facilities, and it has a pretty small environmental footprint overall. We talked about cod, and, you know, again, I think if you're looking for just a deep-fried kind of fish, a tilapia, or even a U.S. farm-raised catfish is a good substitute for cod. Sea bass, the branzino that we talked about earlier, there's a fish called a barramundi. It's an excellent swap, again, because of the recirculating facilities. Finally, with tuna, you know, that's a tough one. I went and researched a fish in Hawaii called the kahala, or it's also called the kona kampachi, which has some benefits as an aquacultured fish. But the other way you can approach the tuna issue is not to eat the really, really big tunas like your bluefin and your yellowfin. Eat more smaller tunas like skipjack tuna, which is often not as prevalent in the marketplace, is a smaller fish, has lower toxins, is more plentiful. Mackerel, also again in the tuna family, has those omega-3 benefits and, you know, is a very very populous fish and in pretty good numbers.
What kind of tuna comes in a can?
Well, there's chunk white, which is nearly always albacore, longfin albacore, and those stocks are in differing shapes. I know in the east, in the Atlantic, we were having some trouble with longfin albacore. I should say, globally, all tuna species are down by about 25%. That's cumulatively in the last 50 years. Bluefin are down 80 to 90%, depending on who you talk to. So chunk white is usually albacore. Chunk light can be several fish. Sometimes it's yellowfin. Sometimes it's skipjack tuna. Sometimes it's a fish I've seen recently more frequently called tongal tuna, which is, again, a smallish tuna from the Indian Ocean. So that's pretty much the breakdown.
And is marketing of different kinds of fish, these ones that maybe are emerging, going to be important? Do they need to be renamed in order to really sell a lot?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. Like, you look at the case of, like, say, tilapia, right? Tilapia now is the fifth most popular seafood in America. It went from being zero to the fifth most in just over, 20 years or so. And I remember I talked to one aquaculturist, and he said the first time he heard the word tilapia, he thought it was a stomach disease.
We're having tilapia for dinner, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Whoa. But it's actually, tilapia is actually its Latin name. And I think it benefited from a lack of marketing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was just this new thing that had nothing associated with it whatsoever. So people know the stories, the famous stories of the fish swaps, you know, the Chilean sea bass that swaps in.
I'm so sorry, Paul, that we are out of time here. Yep. Paul Greenberg's new book is called Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. It's been a really great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.